Birth, Chapter 29. "Sergeant Major," called General Cabarrus with his cell phone, "it's been 4 hours. We have seen nothing of them."
"Same here, General," responded the Sergeant Major.
"Let me put together a scouting party. We'll see where they are," growled Cabarrus. He ended the call and rubbed his stubbly beard with his other hand. At that moment, his cell phone vibrated in his hand. It was NORAD.
"Cabarrus," he said shortly into the phone.
"The EAS has been activated," said the deep voice on the other end of the phone. The Nephilim leader was deliberate and clear.
"We set up kill zones in the two access halls in front of the building complex," he said.
"They have gained access another way," said the voice.
"We are only a few hundred yards from there, but my other team is over a mile away through the tunnels. It will take time to get..."
"We do not have time. They will change everything. Go now and kill them all." And with that, the general recoiled from the force of the darkness on the other end. He ended the call and immediately redialed the phone.
"They have got behind us. They are already at the communication center," said the general.
"Nothing has slipped past us except some grocery delivery folks. But there were only 3 men, said the sergeant major.
"There must be another tunnel I don't know about. Get to Building E, 3rd floor, as quickly as possible.
We'll be there in less than 15 minutes to back you up, but do not hesitate to engage. Repeat, engage them immediately upon arrival.
Double time, Sergeant Major," he shot into the phone as he ended the call and slipped the phone into his pocket.
"We go to Building E right now. They have initiated the EAS. Weapons hot. The other team will be engaged when we arrive, so look alert. Let's move out," shouted the general. They headed down the long main hallway at a jogging pace. He knew the sergeant major would arrive first and at least contain the area if the president's team was well armed. He also knew they had a number of civilians with them, which would not be a problem to eliminate. Jogging for a mile in the cool tunnel as a combat team was at first fortifying to his resolve. He had a mission. He always accomplished his mission. But then he started to think about the task of assassinating a sitting president and what that meant to the government he swore to defend. His team did not know that this was the real president. He had told them he was an impostor and that his companions had stolen classified information. But these were not newly enlisted ground pounders. These were not recruits. They were seasoned mercenary types with multiple tours in hostile territories. They had never fired a round in the U.S., and certainly had never put an American citizen in their gun sights before. He wondered if his leadership was enough. Would they follow his orders? He recalled a story of Vietnam when American soldiers had taken a Red Cross team into a remote village to inoculate the people against smallpox and malaria. When they returned to the village 2 weeks later to use it as a staging area for assaults against a North Vietnamese weapons depot, they were shocked at what they found. In the center of town was a pile of severed arms. Only the arm that was used to administer the inoculation was cut off, and they were stacked in the center of town. It was not a lesson of horror of how vicious the enemy they were facing might be. Far from it. It was a statement of respect for how perfect the North Vietnamese soldier was for following such an order. Did he have perfect soldiers? Was he the perfect leader? Was the dark power that used his lust for power and rank powerful enough to command these men to follow him no matter what? He lowered his head and breathed deeper while he jogged in front of his troop in an effort to strengthen his will to follow his master. The 8 men who jogged beside and behind the general were of one mind, strangely enough. They had seen battle before, but never like this.
It seemed like they drank pure adrenaline for days on end, cleaning out the small, disorganized streets of Baghdad, Tikrit, and the endless maze of Fallujah during the surge. They followed a lieutenant or a warrant officer, but never a general. Their efforts barely got them a pat on the back. If they got hurt, the medical system was focused only on the process of getting their warfighter back into the field. They felt like plow horses at times, turning over the dirt of the Middle East so something else could be planted in its place. They each believed that this mission, for which they were hand-picked, would be close to the top of the food chain. There would be promotions. There might be bonuses. They knew the truth was not important, because at the end of the day, they were never there anyway. They were making good time, and they could see the domestic water supply pump house. It was running, but there was no one outside the structure. The musky smell of water and plastic is slightly more difficult to breathe as smoothly as they had done for the previous mile. They pushed on past the door that said Building A. The sweat dripped from their faces and they could tell their shirts were soaked. The cool cave air made the green cotton of their camouflage fatigues cold against the skin. It was a different environment than the sweltering, dry heat of Iraq. Building E came quickly and the team split up between the stairs and the elevator. They would enter the third floor during a firefight, because the Sergeant Major's team would already be engaged. The team had already depersonalized the combatants they were about to face. It would be easy to end them all, no matter what they looked like. They had heard the pleas for mercy 1,000 times. You squeezed the trigger and watched them die anyway, knowing that the innocent would be sorted from the terrorist by the Creator who gave them life. The general had given them orders. It wasn't their prerogative to question them. No military force could survive if the soldiers continually questioned the orders. There was blood splattered on the stainless steel walls of the elevator, and a half dozen small bullet holes in the rear wall when the general and four men climbed inside. It was okay. They knew the sergeant major was as tough as they come, and he would have charged anyway. There would be fewer to fight when they arrived. The enemy would not expect a backup force. The door slid shut, and the elevator surged for the third floor. When the door opened, they would shoot everything that was not in fatigues. Within seconds of their arrival, the other four soldiers would burst through the stair access door, creating a crossfire that would confuse the enemy and make them feel like their situation was hopeless. In the next few seconds, before the elevator reached the third floor, they might hear gunfire and men screaming positions and handoffs. They might hear a woman's scream. And then the elevator came to a stop. In 1 or 2 seconds, the door would open, and there would be nowhere to hide. There would be no choice but to run forward into the fight. There was no beachhead. There were no barricades. Only the drawbridge of the elevator doors opening into the fray would deliver them into the chaos. But there was no sound. There was no gunfire. The doors opened and the room was dark as night. They could smell the cordite of battle, but only the elevator door light illuminated the room. Within seconds, they rolled out of the door and scattered around the room. They were standing at first, with their eyes straining to see something behind their backlit reticles. There was nothing. A chair. A couch. And some small tables. 1, 3, 7 bodies lying on the floor in camouflage in the lobby area. One pair of booted legs could be seen a few yards away lying in the hallway, the body just out of sight around the corner. As though, like a sudden collision, the other four men came tumbling through the stair access door. The general jumped in his skin and almost fired his drawn .45 semi-automatic pistol at the intrusion. As though frozen in time, the eight men stood there gripping their rifles and moving their red dots around the room to try to find a target. Battle was always confusing, and it almost never went exactly the way it was planned. Something was always out of place. "This room is secure," whispered the general. "Let's go down that hallway. Follow me." The general had always seemed to have a guardian angel around him. He could walk through a battle with bullets whizzing all around and never seem to get struck. He told his former wife that he had special powers and that nothing could hurt him. She left him after one of his particularly violent drinking binges, where he stood on top of the coffee table with his .45 and yelled at the demon to come and get him. The men pointed their semi-automatic combat rifles down the hallway, and the general began to move. Suddenly, there was a flash of sound. Rhino was still behind the couch where Smith had told him to be. As the blast of guns and the sound of orders and the grunts of bodies being struck with bullets, he remained secure. Now it was time to move. Rhino put his shoulder against the couch and pushed as though he was crashing through San Francisco's defensive line. The couch struck the eight men standing behind the general and took them off their feet. At that same moment, the lights in the lobby came on. There stood Jones and John with their rifles looking down at the pile of soldiers on the floor. They were quickly disarmed. "On your bellies, snakes," yelled Jones. "Hands on the back of the head." The general was missed by the couch and ran down the hall. Rhino stood up and began to move after him. As if in slow motion, they moved down the hallway. The side door opened and Smith came into the hallway from the radio room. Riker was close behind him. That was his mission. It was time to complete it. "Riker, time to punch the clock on your presidency, you phony bastard," he growled. Bet moved before Loretta and Orvan could stop her. They were huddled at the end of the hallway behind a large potted plant. "Put the gun down, you son of a bitch," she yelled with her fists bunched up tightly. "My mother used to say the same thing. You think I wouldn't shoot a woman if that's what you are? Think again," as he raised his .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol in line with Bet's approaching body and squeezed the trigger. As though the bullet came out of the 4 1/2-inch barrel in slow motion, it twisted through the air at 800 feet per second and stopped upon entering the chest of Agent Michael Smith. He had leaped in front of the shot and saved the life of Bet Dyson. "No!" screamed Bet as she unclenched her fists and tried to reach for the fallen agent. It was too late. Riker grabbed her a few moments later and pulled her into the radio room and slammed the door. The general swung his gun toward the door the same second and began pulling the trigger over and over again. Each round punched through the insulated steel door, leaving a hole the size of the average thumb. Bet had fallen to the floor with her hands over her ears in a rage of tears and grief. The bullets flew over her head and struck the opposite wall beside the radio console. The raging general moved the gun with each shot in an attempt to cover the distance across the room with his maniacal mission to assassinate the president. 4, 5, 6, the rounds kept coming. As though in one fluid series of events, Rhino's enormous fist smashed into the general's left cheekbone, shattering it and driving him to the floor of the hallway, very close to the still, warm body of Agent Smith. "You are not the man," said Rhino. As the shooting stopped, Riker opened the door, now pocked with holes. He emerged to face John. "Mr. President, we must complete the message to the world." "We're running out of time," said John. "But Agent Smith is down. He needs," Riker began. "That's his job, Mr. President. Let us take care of him." Enoch returned from the front room where Jones and Hadid had the eight soldiers held on the floor at gunpoint. He walked over to Smith and looked down at his motionless body bleeding onto the tile floor. He picked up the general's gun still clutched in his hand and handed it to John. "Go on. Take the president inside and continue the broadcast, said Enoch in his deep, resonant voice. President Robert Riker turned his back on the hallway and walked back to the radio console. John gently closed the door, sealing Bette's exhausted sobbing inside the radio room as though to disconnect her from the body of Agent Smith.